Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, 20 years have passed since the attack on the World Trade Center in New York on September 11, 2001. 2,977 people were killed in the various terrorist attacks that day. Now, then U.S. President George W. Bush declared Washington's war on terror. Since then, that war has caused at least 1 million people to be killed around the world. And millions of others have become refugees while terrorism has expanded. And this 9/11, like 9/11 in 2001, the Taliban is in power in Afghanistan. So what was accomplished besides death and destruction in the U.S.'s war on terror? Now I'd like to welcome my guests to this spotlight. Author and journalist Jim Kavanaugh out of New York. And author and former U.S. diplomat Michael Springman out of Washington, D.C. Thank you both for being with us.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let's start this off, staying in D.C. and with Michael. Michael, there's still so much mystery and confusion behind the whole attacks on 9/11. Why do you think that's still the case 20 years later?
Well, I think it's because you keep a whole series of stories rolling out. You'll never get down to the basics of the real story, as one African journalist told me. You have explanations and possibilities, and you throw these out, you confuse people with what they're hearing. Anyone who questions the knowledge that jet fuel burning doesn't melt steel is denounced as a conspiracy theorist and as some kind of agent of some disinformation campaign. You don't get the clear story on anything. And the emphasis is always on something else, on the Saudis, on the Taliban, or Osama bin Laden, but you hear nothing at all about the involvement of the Israeli government and the dancing Israelis in New Jersey during the collapse of the towers. There's all sorts of stories, but you are not permitted to get to the real story.
Okay. Well, Jim, why do you think, let's go with, of course, Michael just talked about the Saudi involvement or the lack thereof, but let's look at that. Why do you think that the country where most of the hijackers were from, Saudi Arabia, was actually never attacked?
Because American oil businesses need Saudi Arabia, and the American, and also the American strategic plan for the world depends on having those conservative monarchist regimes, anti-nationalist regimes in place. They've been since Franklin Delano Roosevelt made the deal with King Fahd, I think it was, that they would be an American ally in the Middle East and be a bulwark against any kind of secular socialist, certainly nationalism. And that's the role that they play. And they're also enormously powerful and wealthy. And the Bush family itself at 9/11 was, linked up through the Carlyle Group of Saudi Arabia. So, you know, Saudi Arabia plays a crucial role for the United States, both financially and politically in the world. And therefore, they can be as radically Islamist fundamentalist as they want.
So Jim, what are you saying? What are we saying when we say that? I mean, all of this and the whole pomp and circumstances and of course, it was a very somber occasion, and George W. Bush and talking about that we're going to get the terrorists and you can't do this to America. So are you telling me that that Saudi relationship is more important than the thousands of lives that were taken in the United States on 9/11?
Well, I'm telling you that the issue of thousands of lives that were taken became secondary very quickly. It was from the moment it happened, it was quite clear, and we know this from firsthand accounts, that the administration was hell-bent on going after Iraq, on using this as a springboard, as an excuse to go after Iraq, essentially, eventually. So they weren't interested that much in the thousands. They were interested in what they could use it for in terms of their own geostrategic plans.
And, okay, and we're going to talk Saudi about Arabia I'm going to talk about target. Iraq a little bit later in the program. But, Michael, Afghanistan was attacked allegedly to get whom the U.S. alleged was the mastermind behind 9/11, Osama bin Laden. But after all the troops and firepower sent into Afghanistan, the U.S. did not get him there. How can the U.S. justify the invasion of Afghanistan when its main mission wasn't even accomplished there, and appears that the job could have actually been done by special forces who allegedly did do the job in Pakistan?
Well, there's no justification whatsoever for the destruction of Afghanistan, the Afghan people, their culture, their society, their infrastructure. It was simply a move to further weaken a Muslim country and following on from other Muslim countries such as Iraq. We've got the idea that the Americans are a city upon the hill, that they can do no wrong, that the world looks up to them because of their great democratic values, when such events as Afghanistan show that those values have no meaning whatsoever. They're all fantasy. And, of course, the Americans were told that Osama bin Laden was in Afghanistan and asked the Afghans for him, and the Afghans simply said, well, yeah, give us some justification, give us some reason to get him over, and we'll do it. And the Americans never could, and I guess to this day, 20 years later, still never would justify their demands for bin Laden and to act expeditiously when the Taliban offered to hand him over.
Well, Jim, as you were talking about Iraq, let's look at Iraq, which was another country attacked during the U.S.'s war on terrorism, and of course the alleged reason the Iraqi regime's possession of weapons of mass destruction was a total lie. The country was destroyed. Who pays, Jim? What happens? Who pays? I mean, we're talking about this on this 20-year anniversary, which of course is a sad occasion for Americans and other people in the world. Who pays for these other lives that have been destroyed, countries that have been destroyed, like Iraq?
Well, the people of those countries pay, most of all. I mean, look, as an American, we pay. We pay in terms of our public money and in terms of the lives of the soldiers who have been lost. But overwhelming, it's not only the people of the countries, but the infrastructure of the countries, the whole collective structure of the countries that has been destroyed. You know, I was born and raised in New York, and I was living less than a mile away from the World Trade Center on September 11th. But I was also happened to be that day in an Arab and Muslim country on September 11th, 2001. And everybody in the country was sympathetic, expressing their solidarity, their horror at what happened. And what the United States did is use the events as a springboard for attack and demolish Muslim countries around the world, starting with Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria, and do away with all that goodwill and turn it to resentment and hatred and for good reasons. And so what you have is, you know, when you watch a country like Iraq, when you watch bridges being blown up, I mean, that takes something to build a bridge. You know, that destroys the infrastructure of a country. So the United States went around and did that for 20 years, committing 9/11s against the people of those countries, you know, monthly or whatever. And that's what happened. The people of those countries pay, and they're still paying.
Yeah, well, Michael, we know that former U.S. General Wesley Clark, who revealed that right after the 9/11 attacks, that the Pentagon had made the decision to attack 7 countries in 5 years. What does all of this mean? Was this all pre-planned?
Yes, indeed. The whole thing started with recruiting terrorists for Afghanistan. People recruited in the CIA's Jeddah Consulate, where I served, and was ordered to issue terrorist visas to recruitment offices in the United States in almost every state, including Washington, D.C. The people involved in the Afghan war decided that they had created a cadre of people who were very good at blowing things up and shooting things down. And I went into great detail in this in my book, Visas for Al-Qaeda, CIA Handouts That Rocked the World. When I talked about the creation of the Arab-Afghan Legion, essentially crazy Muslim fighters, as Cheryl Bernard said, the most extreme people that they could find and the most dangerous, to overthrow the government of Afghanistan. And then later on, of course, the Americans saw that they had a marvelous cadre, and they used that cadre in Yugoslavia, headed up by Osama bin Laden. And that's what created the name-changing Islamic terrorist base. It started out with Al-Qaeda, and then it became ISIS, and then it became IS, and it may morph into something else, but they are essentially the same people the Americans had recruited and trained and financed with the help of course, Saudi Arabia and Pakistan. And these people were essentially the basis for the destruction and the overthrow of these 5 countries in 7 years. They were countries the Americans didn't trust, didn't like. They were too socialist, like Yugoslavia. They were too secular, like Iraq or Syria. And there were, of course, many instances in the Arab and Muslim world, they were enemies of Israel. And, of course, Israel dictates American policy. You had these people that were not as organized as the United States Marines, but could be aimed and let loose in any direction in any country that the United States wanted to see founder. And this has been planned from the highest levels down. It's kept up the planning throughout several administrations. You had its basis, in fact, in this project for the New American Century, which was a rewrite of a paper prepared for the apartheid entity's government on military control of the region. So it was basically planned well in advance and executed markedly, remarkably well. And, of course, the propaganda got better and better. And the planning and the organization got better and better through more and skilled practice. So we see it now today everywhere in the world, and it's not the American invasion or the Israeli threat of invasion or the Israeli bombing or whatever. It's something wrong with that country. We have a responsibility to protect the people living there, and we have to help them, and we have to overthrow this repressive government and replace it with a puppet government of our own.
Michael, when you say, yeah. Sorry to jump in here, but when you say pre-planned, I mean, because also the catalyst for the other side of all of this was the 9/11 attacks itself. Was that also pre-planned, you think, or not?
Well, when I was in Jeddah in the late 1980s and early 90s, I was ordered to issue visas to people that the CIA and the American government wanted to have, such as an Iranian working in a rug shop in Jeddah. The CIA base chief wanted me to bring him to the United States because we wanted to have a conversation with him and a debriefing session and whatever. And I was in charge of the non-immigrant visa section. This happened several successors of mine. Shana Steinger issued 11 visas to the 15 Saudis who got their visas while in the kingdom. And, of course, Shana Steinger went on for 20 more years in the State Department, despite having issued the visas that brought down a couple of tall, ugly buildings in New York City. So I think that, yeah, it was planned, it was carefully planned, and it was a long, drawn-out process.
Well, Jim, I mean, what was accomplished with this whole war on terror? The U.S. is poorer, its reputation worse, the world is less safe, and the U.S. has lost the war in Afghanistan. So what was gained from all of this?
Well, I think it's important to realize that something was gained, and the people who wanted to do it got what they wanted. They
Let's talk
destroyed
about
the
what does that
Iraqi
mean, the
state.
people? Which people and what did they
Well,
get?
I think primarily the Israeli lobby in the United States. They wanted the destruction of any powerful state that was a resistant state to Israel. They wanted the destruction of Iraq and of the Iraqi army and of the Iraqi state, the coherence of the Iraqi state. They were very mad in 1991 when Bush one didn't go forward and go into Baghdad. And Dick Cheney at the time said, "If we do that, it's crazy. There'll be chaos in Iraq." But they kept pressing that issue. The Israeli lobby in the United States is very powerful, and it's not just an exogenous thing. I mean, hundreds and thousands of people who work in the foreign policy apparatus are convinced that the interests of Israel are the interests should be the interests of the United States. So Israel got the destruction of the Iraqi state. They got the destruction of all the axes of resistance. Libya. They got the destruction of Libya. These were states that provided financial support to the Palestinian resistance. They've succeeded in weakening the Syrian state to the point where it has to defend itself constantly against attack, and a third of its territory is still occupied. So from the point of view, and the Israeli ministers have said it, "We'd much rather have ISIS in power than Assad in Syria." They wanted to destroy, systematically look at the states that were targeted, the axes of resistance to Israeli colonialism and Israeli hegemony in the Middle East. And that's why the next one is, they haven't finished with Syria, and their next target is Iran, because they've done away with a lot of the others. So it's been a great success in a lot of ways for people who want, for that program, which was the Annan program. I think Michael was referring to that, and the project for the New American Century program. So, people have to realize they weren't being stupid, or they weren't misunderstanding. American people were, because they were being fed a narrative that had nothing to do with what was going on. But, and that's one of the reasons why Afghanistan, they will pull troops out of Afghanistan, because it's very important. But it doesn't impact centrally the issue of Israel and the Zionist supremacy in the Middle East. And so it's going to be it, that it, Af Afghanistan, in some sense, was for the Americans. For the American political class, an amuse-bouche of certain kind to get the American people ready for the war in Iraq, the attack on Iraq.
Well, Michael, you talked about the dancing Israelis before, and now Jim has just talked about the Israeli lobby benefiting from all of this. Of course, this is not talked about on mainstream media in the United States and probably would not even be allowed. What does this all mean, though, at the end of the day for the American people? That basically they have been sacrificed for the sake of the Zionist state, and who has to do the job to basically be able to inform the American people in order to bring a change if all of this is true?
Well, this whole thing has happened because the Israelis control the news media, whether it's radio, television stations, newspapers, or you name it, they have access, they have control. You look at there's something like five or six corporations controlling news media in the United States, and if you look at the names, they are Jews or appear to be Jews, and it's their narrative that gets out. And as the African journalist I quoted earlier said, these are the people that have the money. And people with an alternative viewpoint who have a real insight into the situation cannot make any money at it because there are no organizations that are going to pay them for their reportage. So it's basically information control. And the Americans, unfortunately, accept all of this. They believe that their government is right, that they're being told the truth, that you can't possibly question Washington and its foreign policy decisions. So What it's going to take is a major revolution from the bottom up in the United States, and organizations that are willing to be formed that will pay people, good journalists, to write the truth and not what Tel Aviv or Washington, D.C. dictates. So the whole issue is basically information control and getting around it, and that's extremely difficult.
All right, I would love to continue this conversation, but unfortunately we are out of time. I thank both of you for being with me, Arthur and journalist Jim Kavanaugh out of New York, and Arthur and former U.S. diplomat Michael Spreeman out of Washington, D.C. And thank you so much for staying with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
And God said, let there be light, and there was light.
The Creator made Adam in his image, then placed the world in his care. May you walk alongside the Creator in righteousness.
God of Abraham, take my child into thy hands, that he may live to thy service.
God has spoken to us before, through Abraham, Noah, Moses, and through Jesus Christ. Why should we be so surprised that God speaks to us now through Muhammad?
Viewpoint. A critique of movies with religious themes on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio. We were discussing the movie God's Not Dead, number 3, in Light and Darkness, for a while, and we'd like to continue that in this episode too, with our dear guests, Sayyid Abdullah and Brother Hussein. Assalamu alaikum, Sayyid Abdullah, and welcome to the program again.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And Brother Hussein, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the studio.
Wa alaikum salam, glad to be here.
Welcome. Well, before we continue talking about this movie and continue our program, Viewpoint, let's take a listen to a part of this movie and then discuss it.
People are broken. They're lost. They're searching for meaning, for purpose.
Oh, church is the answer to those problems, huh?
Well, church is a place for people to seek, to grapple with those difficult questions, to find hope and truth. And you know that.
You were listening to a part of the movie God's Not Dead, The Light and Darkness, in this program, Viewpoint on IRIB English Radio. Brother Hussein, this part was referring to the fact that, you know, there is this role, or it's talking about the role of religion in life, in everyday life, or in modern life. You know, in lots of countries, especially the secular countries or Western countries, you see that religion has lost its value or lost its meaning and lost its application to today's life. Don't you agree?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yeah, I guess so. You know, there's that whole concept, like you said, the agnostics. And I feel like a lot of religious people these days are leaning towards them, you know, keeping it very civil and very, you know, diplomatic, I guess. So, like there are things that are, you know, occurring in today's world where, you know, you can apply your religion in. But I feel like a lot of people, like you said, don't take that chance because, you know, there are own personal reasons, I guess.
Mm-hmm. I see. Sayyid Abdullah, do you think that religion adds meaning to life?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Before I answer this question, let me give a bit of comment over the question that you asked, Brother Hussein.
Thank
before.
You.
When it comes to religion in secular countries, religion has lost its value, its sense. Do you know why? Because it was replaced by the civil law.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, in religions, we have thou I should not kill, thou I should not steal, thou I should not do this and that. These ones became part and parcel of the law itself,
mm-hmm.
that you cannot commit a crime. So when people grow up in such societies where the law itself is controlling everything, that you cannot commit a crime, you cannot even, you know, hate crimes, or you can't even now call people by names or be discrimination against them, that you will be prosecuted by the law.
Mm-hmm.
So it basically, the religion itself was incorporated inside the civil law itself. So people say, well, I don't need religion anymore. Where if you
so religion, it started the all. It started the law. And the law is based on religion.
Exactly. So the law itself is religion, but in a different cover, in a different clothes.
Yes.
But if you go back, for example, 100 years ago, in most even civilized countries, there was no civil law. But people were abiding by the religious law. See how time has changed?
Because America, for example, or you know, those Western countries were started by church.
Exactly. So the church was the prosecution office. Even in the movie itself, it mentioned a few times is that they used to kill people, the church, because the church was the power. Now that power was given to the government, and now people say, well, yeah, religion loses its value. In reality, it does not lose its value, but the laws were made into civil law.
Mm-hmm.
Where if you come to our countries in the East, you'll find many countries don't have civil law, where the majority of people, they abide by the Islamic law. For example, in some countries, Iraq, for example, the law there is very weak. It makes no sense. But people themselves, they have that code of religion.
Mm-hmm.
I can't kill, I can't steal, I can't do this, I can't
do that.
Of conduct, even though the law itself does not exist. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So time shifts and it takes a different clause. But the religion itself, like I said, it lost its value in the civil world only because it was handed to the civil court.
So a new question arises here. When you say that we have this modern way of looking at life, and then we have the civil laws in most countries, and then there's no need actually for the religion or religious laws, because religious law already incorporated, right? So basically, here, there is no role of religion anymore, or religion doesn't play any part in their life, or add anything, any meaning to the life then.
No, so what I want to say is that what you said is correct, half of it is correct. You can't override religion. So what happens is either you incorporate the entire religion in the system and then it would govern, would have a meaning, like you said, the question, then life or religion would have meaning. You can't incorporate half. For example, killing is a crime, right? But then when someone kills, he goes to court, the judge decides what to do. He gives him 5 years, 10 years, a lifetime. That's after the judge.
Mm-hmm.
Where if you go to religion itself, it says if you kill, you should be killed. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So you should get the death sentence. So that's not incorporated into religion. So either you take the whole parcel of religion, or you're going to, you know, take it just the things that suits you, and then you make up the rest.
Yes.
If you take the entire system as a package, as a parcel, and incorporate it into the civil system, then life would have meaning.
I see.
If you don't, then life would have no meaning, or religion would have no meaning at all. Either you apply it, even as Muslims, we say, well, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, when he comes, he will apply the absolute Islam clause to the entire earth, and then therefore it's going to be justice. Even the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, Amir al-Mu'minin and the Imam, they never acclaimed to come to establish the laws of God as Allah wants them.
Yes.
They said, no, we're here to deliver.
People were not ready, actually, for that kind of law.
Yeah.
People and the whole world was not ready, right?
Yeah, exactly. So they said, you know what? There will come a time where one of our descendants will establish that law to its perfection.
Yes.
So right now, like I said, we have crimes. We have punishment for them, but not the Islamic or the Christian punishment for it.
Let's take another break and we'll be back.
Paul tells us that even if you can speak the language of both man and angels, if you lack love, brothers and sisters, you're just making a lot of noise. Maybe you're the world's smartest person and you have a great faith that can move mountains, or you give all your money to the poor, or you give your body over to hardship. My Bible says, without love, you say nothing. Without love, you gain nothing. Without love, you are nothing.
Back to the program, Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this. And we are talking about the movie God's Not Dead, A Light in Darkness. Brother Hussein, you know, there is this part in the movie that, you know, they are talking about a couple of things, at least. They are giving examples of items which cannot be really compensated or accounted for by science or even money, you know?
Okay.
Like, for example, you can't buy life, basically, all right? If the death, the time, the deadline is coming, like the angel of death,
yeah, if death
is going to take you away,
really,
right,
yeah,
and you're going to leave this world, no doctors will be able actually to save you, right?
Yeah.
Or we have lots of other things, like a religious center, for example. In this movie, they are going to burn down this reverence church.
Yeah.
All right?
Well, they're going to close it, yeah.
They're going to close it down. They're going to burn it down. They're going to, not burning, but basically they're going to destroy it and then put something else instead, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So the value of a religious center is very important,
of course,
at least to some people, you know, if not to the atheists, but to the religious people, it's very important. And you cannot buy it. Even the university promised to, like, compensate it with,
yeah,
money, right? That was the whole battle was about,
of
right?
Of course.
So don't you agree?
Yes. So the thing is, I feel like if Pastor Dave, the guy, the main character in the movie, if he really believed in God and God is good and God having a plan for
mm-hmm.
him,
yes,
and his church, then he'd see, for example, that, like, the fire burning down his church, he'd see it, for example, like, as a sign that, hey, maybe this is a time for a change. And he admits in the movie that he doesn't want to go,
mm-hmm.
Like, he doesn't know where to go,
yes,
now, like, that has, he wants to go back to the previous days, back to how things were.
Yes.
That's what he says. So if he really had faith in God, he would see this as an opportunity. Hey, you know what? It's, you know, the church is a resemblance of Christianity.
Yes.
Okay? And there are a lot of you know, religions in this university. So why not move to another place and
okay.
give space for you know, other religions to come in?
Okay. Let's take another break and we'll be back.
A minute ago, you were doing all right.
I'm just saying, I think it's time that Christians stand up for themselves.
Hmm. People were drawn to Jesus because of his love, his patience and kindness. He managed to preach the truth without losing himself in the bargain. He was gentle with the meek and hard as a rock with the arrogant. And when he talked to the foolish, he was patient and never became a fool himself. And he was never proud, David.
You just listened to another part of the movie God's Not Dead, A Light in Darkness, on IRIB English Radio. In this program, Viewpoint, the Movie Critique. Sayyid Abdullah, it seems that there are always two approaches to everything. Like the radical one, all right, to religion. For example, some people are really too religious. And they push their ideas, that they'd like to impose their ideas, like the evangelists, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They'd like to impose their ideas on the other people,
yeah.
And there's always the mild and softer and more loving or lovable approach to life,
yeah,
including religion, all right? Don't you agree? It's like sometimes when you compare even the followers of the religion, their way of or perspective of or outlook to life is somehow different from even the, the creator, even the prophet and the imams, for example, for our Shias,
mm-hmm.
you know, the followers, in fact, take a different route,
yeah.
It looks.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, in every religion, you find radicals and softer people, like you put it, right? So there's always two wings, the
mm-hmm.
right wing and the left wing. And this is just natural. This happens due to the fact that people misinterpret or mistranslate religion to
mm-hmm.
their own liking. For example, take Islam, for example.
Yes.
We have ISIS, and ISIS believe that everyone who is not my way should be killed.
My way or the highway.
Yeah, my way or the highway. That's their understanding of religion, and they will utilize verses from the Quran, they utilize hadith, narrations from the Prophet to, you know, prove their statement is correct. On the other hand, you have people saying, no, Islam is love, Islam is peace, and this and that. And also, they would use the Quran and the Hadith to prove their claim.
Yes.
So this happens to mistranslation and misunderstanding of the faith itself.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, for us as Muslims, we always need to refer back to those whom Allah has made gods on religion, which are the imams for us.
True.
So even that concept applies to Christianity, applies to Judaism, applies to everybody who have a faith system, a belief, where you always have two sides. And then, like I said, that only happens because of their mistranslation, misinterpretation, and misunderstanding of the text of religion itself.
Thank you very much. Let's take another break and listen to another part of the movie, and we'll discuss and criticize that part.
Although St. James has meant everything to me, although it's been my whole life, I would gladly give all that up for this, for you. So I am withdrawing my lawsuit against the school and dropping the charges against Adam Richardson. I've also agreed to turn this land over to Hadley University so that they can use it to build a new student center, a long overdue addition to this campus. Chancellor Ellsworth has assured me that this new facility will have a space for our Harbor House, led by our campus minister, Josh Wheaton. As for me, I'm going to build a new church. And I don't know how, I don't know where yet, but I'm willing to bet that God can handle the details. And I'd love your help, all of you. We could build something new, together. But for now, please, put down those signs. Put them down. Go ahead, lay them down. Let's stop shouting at each other and start listening. It's the only way that things will get better. Now, please, take these candles and let's stand together.
You just listened to another part of the movie, God's Not Dead, number 3, A Light in Darkness. In this program, Viewpoint on IRIB English Radio. Brother Hussein, I'm going to ask you the last question regarding this movie, the message of the movie.
Go ahead.
All right? Well, I believe the message of the movie was tolerance, acceptance, and peace. That is what I call the softer version of religion, like we discussed it in the last part with Sayyid Abdullah, about the radical view, violent view, like the way of the followers sometimes, as he referred to ISIS and the like. And we also have the mild and softer version of all religions. And this is emphasized throughout the whole movie. I mean, this theme gets repeated throughout the whole movie. God is good all the time.
Yeah.
This is what I believe the message of the movie is. Don't you agree?
Well, kind of. I feel like there's another part to it.
Uh-huh.
I feel like this film feels more like a political statement rather than an installment that helps answer these controversial questions about religion.
Mm-hmm.
If I can cite an article from Vox, this writer...
Very short.
This writer, Alyssa Wilkinson, who was raised as a conservative Christian, says that despite their titles, the movies, the God's Not Dead, they haven't really been about arguments for the existence of God, either anecdotal or philosophical, which I agree. I agree with this because I feel like it's more of a political, it has more of a political message.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Brother Hussein and Sayyid Abdullah, and thank you, our dear listeners. You were listening to the program Viewpoint on IRIB English Radio. We criticize the movie God's Not Dead, A Light in Darkness. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
How do we actually know that our values are any more valid than anyone else's?
God called me to fight.
God calls you, you call me.
His brother is a lawyer. Are you kidding me?
What you're doing, it's against the law.
We're wasting our time here.
We cannot respond to hate with more hate.
Is it true?
I just don't see God's mercy here, especially not from Pastor Dave.
He's human, Keaton.
He's supposed to be a man of God.
What am I doing wrong?
You don't get to play innocent.
You did this!
The whole world knows what the church is against, but it's getting harder and harder to know what it's for.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Is the UK turning into a totalitarian state? Well, according to former British Home Secretary David Blunkett, they are certainly heading in that direction, with the proposed police crime and sentencing courts bill, which is being debated this week. He is not alone. 600,000 Brits put their name to a petition calling for the bill to be dropped, including 700 academics. 245 organisations have also called the bill an attack on fundamental rights, along with three UN special rapporteurs and the UK's Parliamentary Joint Committee on Human Rights, who called the bill, quote, oppressive and wrong. While there are many aspects of the legislation that has worried rights groups and advocates since the bill was proposed, there is one particular aspect that has recently began raising eyebrows.
The bill proposes to increase the sentence length for assault on emergency workers from 12 months to 2 years. On the surface, this may seem appropriate, but what some activists are concerned about is the way that this will disproportionately target people from ethnic minority backgrounds who are already significantly more likely to have force used against them than their white counterparts.
Dean alleges he was attacked by British police officers back in 2013 in the city of Manchester, but somehow found himself charged with resisting arrest.
But again, I'm 6'2", quite a big lad. Straight away, the police officer see my body as a weapon, and I got the whole, he's resisting. Next thing you know, I've got six police officers on my back, like punching me, kicking me, doing whatever. They can do things to people like me and people like you with the full knowledge that the law fully protects them. And even when, like I say, when I was basically attacked by the police, all of the officers who were there kind of corroborated the same story, which was false.
Marco, not his real name, has a similar story. He was at an anti-racist demonstration when police were seen attacking protesters, yet Marco found himself charged with assaulting emergency services. Marco asked us to distort his voice.
The police was using
that. This was clear in court by the footages that the police were using disproportionate force, and there was no real reason for doing that. And they even confirmed that in their witness testimony in court. And it was incredible to see that they could just claim in court that they were just punching people in the face to stop them from going to Trafalgar Square. And this was used against me, ultimately, just because I was defending myself and those around me.
Ahmed Kabbalah, London.
Nowadays, landings of local and international flights in Kabul International Airport has turned into a familiar scene. On Wednesday, the first official flight of Iran's Mahan Airlines landed in Kabul since Taliban takeover of Afghanistan in mid-August.
Iran's Mahan Airlines flight landed in Kabul International Airport with over a dozen Iranian passengers. It would return with tens of passengers, including Afghan nationals.
Earlier, some Qatari and UN-related aircrafts had resumed their flights to and from Kabul International Airport.
There is a Qatari aircraft landing here in the Kabul International Airport. According to Taliban sources, they are struggling to attract more foreign support, especially when it comes to managing the issue of Kabul International Airport.
In the meantime, the Taliban welcomed the resumption of Iran's commercial flights to Kabul, calling on international community to add to the number of their flights, bringing humanitarian aid to Afghanistan.
We welcome the resumption of the international flights, but the fact is our countrymen need urgent humanitarian aid. So I think the resumption of such flights paves the way for the regional countries and international bodies to send more humanitarian aid to Afghanistan.
Tehran was one of the largest donors at the 2002 Tokyo conference, pledging more than India, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Turkey, Norway, Switzerland, Australia and Pakistan combined. Iran is also hosting around 3 million Afghans, including around 1 million refugees and 2 million undocumented migrants, according to the United Nations. Many of them have been residing for more than four decades. Kabul International Airport resumes its commercial international flights, while Qatar and Taliban are jointly managing all security and technical issues of the airport. However, Taliban officials here say they are working to make Kabul International Airport fully operational. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell has posed a series of questions to EU legislators in the light of the Afghanistan catastrophe. He asked, what does it mean for our relations with the US? And then he went on.
What does it mean for the development of European strategic autonomy, for our security and for our defence policy?
During the two-hour European Parliament debate, at least a dozen lawmakers told Borrell the last thing the EU needs is more military spending.
The lessons to be learned. We have to end universal interventionism that has only led to disasters in Syria, Iraq and Afghanistan.
Apparently, the West demonstrated enormous arrogance in Afghanistan.
In overshooting self-confidence, instead of helping nation-building, we try to impose nation-building.
The US-led invasion of Afghanistan resulted in a countless number of civilian deaths and also life-changing injuries. We have visited a center for asylum seekers in Brussels. As they wait for help, people here feel let down by EU and Belgian authorities.
They don't care about women, they don't care about children. Why they do like this? What's the difference between Afghanistan and Belgium?
The plight of Afghan refugees was also talked about at length during the European Parliament debate.
The selfishness of many European authorities and political parties that showed no solidarity towards those refugees that left the country.
The reason given for going into the country to defeat terrorism was rubbished.
You were killing innocent people, women and children. You were creating terrorists, fighting migration. You were destroying the place. You were creating migrants.
The European Economic and Social Committee has published a statement pleading with EU leaders to cooperate in a meaningful way with key countries surrounding Afghanistan, including Iran, Pakistan, China, India and Russia, in order to achieve the stabilisation of Central Asia. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The Turkish foreign minister said that Turkey is working with the United Nations to resettle Syrian refugees in Syria. Mevlut Cavusoglu added that the international community has started to understand the gravity of the situation. Cavusoglu's comments came days after a visit by UNHCR chief Filippo Grandi, who met both the foreign minister and the Turkish president. Cavusoglu underlined the importance not to force the refugees to return, but encourage them through providing them housing, education, health and employment resources.
We are now receiving better support from the international community for the safe return and repatriation of refugees. We are working to repatriate refugees, especially in Syria, especially with the UN High Commissioner for Refugees.
The AK ruling party is facing criticism from the people and opposition parties for the way it is handling the refugee crisis. Many are blaming the presence of the refugees for the rise in prices and bad economic situation. Turkish people have become very sensitive towards this issue, with some even refusing to deal with foreigners. House owners are now refusing to rent their houses to foreigners, which has created a state of racism in the country that many are calling on the government to find a solution to.
This topic particularly is considered very sensitive to Turkey, and it also concerns other countries in the region that are also hosting refugees, such as Jordan, Lebanon and Iraq. Turkey is pushing towards this solution due to several reasons. The main one is the upcoming election and the opposition using the refugee card against the ruling party. Another reason is the people's pressure, who are blaming the presence of Syrian refugees for the deteriorating economic situation in the country. Therefore, the current Turkish government is trying to fix this issue before 2023 elections.
UNHCR says Syria is still considered too dangerous to send refugees back. UNHCR spokesperson says that only a political solution would allow people to return, assuring that refugees should have the right to voluntarily return in safe and dignified conditions. However, several countries, including Turkey, are pressuring the Syrian refugees to return to their home country, claiming it is safe now for their return. Turkey has long been hosting migrants and refugees from different countries in the region. However, with the deteriorating economic situation in the country, people are now calling on their government to stop receiving more refugees and send the already existing ones home. Rahşan Saglam, Istanbul.
It was supposed to be seamless trading post-Brexit, but it doesn't seem to be working, and the developments of the past few days are a testament. The Northern Ireland Protocol, agreed upon by the UK and EU to avoid trade problems, has become a problem itself. Now the UK is threatening to unilaterally suspend it.
Article 16 says that this article can be triggered unilaterally by either side if there's some aspect of the treaty which is causing unforeseen social, economic or environmental problems. But there's nothing about the way that the Northern Ireland Protocol is operating now which is unforeseen. It has led de facto to a border between the six counties of the north of Ireland and Britain.
The warning came from Brexit Minister Lord Frost, only days after the leader of Northern Ireland's pro-UK ruling party warned of a new era of violence and instability if the protocol collapsed.
That our political institutions will not survive a failure.
The UK has been pushing for a renegotiation of the protocol, despite Prime Minister Boris Johnson promising during Brexit negotiations that it wouldn't impact the flow of goods to and from Northern Ireland.
There will not be checks on goods going from Northern Ireland to Great Britain, because we're the government of the United Kingdom and we will not institute.
A promise Boris Johnson hasn't been able to keep. Instead, he's announced grace periods since January last year to delay the agreement's full implementation. Meanwhile, the European Union, who threatened legal action but are yet to take it, say the UK made its bed and has to lie in it.
They want to have their cake and eat it. They want both to be able to satisfy their own workers at home and have a smash the red wall, claim to be in favour of Brexit, claim to be in favour of British workers, and at the same time be inside the European club.
The agreement was forged to prevent a hard border between Northern Ireland and EU member Republic of Ireland, and to protect the 1998 Good Friday Agreement. The two sides agreed that goods entering Northern Ireland from the rest of the UK had to be checked according to EU rules. That didn't sit well with the pro-UK unionists.
The Northern Ireland Protocol is underpinned by international law. Any violation of it will dent international trust in the government here. And the whole escalating row over the protocol is yet another episode in the ongoing Brexit saga, rekindling questions about whether or not the UK's divorce from the single market was a good idea after all. Saeed Puriza, London.
It has been known for a long time that the United States is guilty of espionage against its closest ally, the European Union. The matter has just been debated in the European Parliament. It is time the 27-nation bloc had its own intelligence agency to respond, lawmakers suggest.
Le 30 mai dernier.
Just look at the 30th of May. Media investigations showed that Denmark and the NSA cooperated in spying on German Chancellor Angela Merkel and French, Norwegian, Swedish, German journalists.
The fact that EU member Denmark has been working with the US to spy on other EU nations is surely a scandal. Also, Israel has been condemned in the European Parliament for selling its Pegasus military spyware to Saudi Arabia so that Riyadh can hack into the phones of EU politicians, government advisers, lawyers, journalists and academics.
How do you think the world should approach the Israeli government in regards to its involvement? What should be the precedence so that we deter such cases in the future?
The answer, critics argue, is that EU authorities will do nothing because they are afraid of upsetting Washington, Riyadh and Tel Aviv. Some claim motives for this activity given by the US do not add up.
I think America uses the terrorism concept a lot to promote its surveillance agenda. And that's a concern because I think the actual figures of persons who are afflicted by terrorism is actually quite small.
Turning a blind eye to the problem is an insult to citizens, one expert told the European Parliament debate.
All intelligence activity impinges on human rights. It just does. So it impacts on your right to enjoyment, maybe freedom of movement, it might be right to communication and all the rest of it. So the key point there is on the legality.
Another expert who was invited to the debate told legislators that we are only seeing the tip of the iceberg when it comes to foreign nations spying on the EU. Margarita Carrillo from the University of Canada warned that this problem is never going to go away, and therefore EU authorities need to come up with a firm plan in order to preserve the bloc's much talked about values. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Palestinians in the blockaded Gaza Strip demonstrated in front of the Red Cross office in Gaza to drum up support for thousands of Palestinian prisoners languishing inside Israeli prisons and the escapees from the Gilboa Maximum Security Prison. They called for the immediate release of all Palestinian prisoners, especially women and children. During a press conference in front of the Red Cross office, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas conditioned any future prisoner exchange with the regime on the release of the Gilboa escapees.
Our prisoners, including the six escapees, will be freed soon, despite all Zionist leaders' attempts to keep them behind bars. God willing, the six inmates will be on the top of the list of any prisoner swap deal. Those serving multiple life sentences and all female prisoners, as well as sick prisoners, will be freed in any future prisoner swap deal.
The Israeli prison service keeps Palestinian inmates under deplorable conditions, lacking proper hygienic standards. Palestinian prisoners have also been subjected to systematic torture, harassment, and repression. Prisoners' advocacy groups accused the Israeli regime of increasing the ill treatment of Palestinian prisoners following last week's historic escape of the six prisoners.
Following the heroic escape from the Gilbo prison, the Israeli prison service began fierce oppressive campaigns against all Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli jails. It has transferred scores of prisoners to other jails and isolated dozens of them. The campaigns by the Israeli prison service include strip searching and torturing the prisoners. Some prisoners have sustained serious injuries.
A former prisoner who was released during the 2011 prisoner swap deal with the Israeli regime told Press TV, Israel violates all the rights and freedoms granted to prisoners by the 4th Geneva Convention.
Sick prisoners with chronic diseases are in critical condition due to medical negligence by the Israeli regime. Some 230 prisoners have lost their lives inside Israeli jails since 1967 because of medical negligence. Israel is an illegitimate and inhumane regime, and its prison service continues to violate all international laws and norms, mainly in the 4th Geneva Convention regarding the treatment of prisoners.
Experts say that the protection Israel enjoys from Western countries, mainly the United States, gives it the green light to further violate the rights of Palestinians. People here consider Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli jails as political prisoners and freedom fighters. Securing their release is a highly emotive issue for all Palestinians. Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
The International Atomic Energy Agency's Board of Governors opens a weekly session just a day after IAEA Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi's trip to Tehran. Grossi had raised concerns about IAEA access to monitoring equipment in Iran and safeguards-related questions about the country's past nuclear activities. Rafael Grossi said no one could expect him to resolve the outstanding safeguards-related issues with Iran within a 10-hour visit to the country. The most urgent matter, however, the imminent loss of IAEA data, had been adequately addressed. The IAEA's surveillance cameras will now continue.